I think most of you know that we consider this a really good book. And in fact, our tradition is always saying that everything in some way is related to this book. Everything is Torah. Torah covers the world. Hafoch ba, hafoch ba, dechule ba, turn it over and over. Everything is in it. And most Jews just sort of take that on faith. It doesn't mean that you go home and read it over and over and over again to find the world in it. And in fact, what often happens is that rabbis get up and they tell you things that are in the Torah that aren't exactly as the Torah says, but trust us, this is Torah too. And while I know that you trust your rabbis, while I know that you trust some of your rabbis, while I know that you have some trust in a few of your rabbis, I thought that I should take a day, not a Shabbat morning, to explain how it is that we get the world out of this book. The process is called Midrash. And I'm going to show you how Midrash works and how you get remarkable, surprising, and unusual conclusions out of this book that you wouldn't think are in here if you just read the book. Now, some of you may know something about Midrash, especially if you read a very fine essay at the back of this book on Midrash by your rabbi. Yeah, okay. I wrote the essay, so. But don't read it now. Instead, what I want to do is show you a midrash or two, both classical midrash, then Hasidic midrash, and then what we might call contemporary midrash. And altogether, if you hear all these, you will see how much is in this book that you don't see at first glance. Part of it, remember, is that our ancestors recited this book over and over and over again because Judaism was an oral tradition. It was passed down through words, through storytelling, as were most traditions in the world and still are. There are 3,000 languages in the world. Only 78 of them have written traditions. Hebrew and English were rare in the world. Most languages that are spoken don't have a written tradition. But once we started to write things down, then we could preserve them even better generation after generation. So let me start with one example. What happens to Joseph? Joseph gets thrown into a pit by his brothers. Now that wouldn't seem to have anything to do with our parsha this morning, but you'll see it does. When Joseph is thrown into the pit, do you know what the Torah says? It says, the pit was empty, there's no water in it. Now, you and I both know that if a pit is empty, it means there's no water in it. So immediately, we have a problem. What does that mean that there's no water in the pit? If it's empty, it's empty. Now, the usual explanation of a modern commentator would be that since so many pits in the ancient Near East were used to collect water, they wanted to make it very clear this wasn't one of them. This was just an empty pit. But that's not good enough for the rabbis. They say, what does it mean that there was no water in it? There was no Torah in the pit. Now, you might think that makes no sense at all. First of all, who expects Torah in a pit? And second, what does it even mean that there's no Torah in that pit? Obviously, there's not a book down there, right? They didn't, like, throw Joseph into the pit and say, here's some reading material. Have a book. Enjoy yourself. No. But first, the rabbis say, look, obviously, mayim, water, means Torah. How do we know this? Because in Isaiah, and remember that all of the Bible was known to the rabbis very well. In Isaiah, in chapter 55, it says, Kol Tzameh, everyone who's thirsty, l'chu l'mayim, walk to the water. And they say, obviously, if you're thirsty, you're going to walk to the water. So Isaiah must not be talking about regular thirst. What kind of thirst do people have that needs instruction from a prophet? A thirst for spiritual wisdom. So when Isaiah says, walk to the water, what's he talking about? Torah. So now you know that when it says there's no water in there, it might mean there's no Torah. But what's the real proof that there's no Torah in there? In today's Parsha, it says anyone who kidnaps someone else with the purpose of enslaving them or selling them deserves to die. Now, who kidnapped someone else with the purpose of enslaving him or selling him? Joseph's brothers. Did they die? No. Which proves what? There was no Torah in that pit. What they're saying is, Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery before the Torah was given. Remember, it was before Sinai. So the Torah didn't apply yet. They didn't know the punishment for kidnapping was murder, and therefore God did not put them to death. That's how Midrash works. You see how many different answers you got out of that one verse because of the way the rabbis connect the Torah all together and make it yield meaning? Now we know the Torah is Ma'im Chaim, it's the water of life, that actions before someone knows the law are not the same as actions after someone knows the law. And you know that you shouldn't kidnap, just parenthetically. Now, that kind of midrash that connects different verses is one kind of midrash and yields some beautiful meanings. But now I want to talk about two other verses and give you Hasidic midrash. Hasidic midrash tends to talk less about the world and more about your soul. So here's one. It says in our parsha, at the very beginning, if you go to war and you take a beautiful woman captive, because after all, when you take prisoners in a town or you take a town, one of the prisoners might be a beautiful woman, and presumably she's unmarried or her husband is killed in war, it says after a certain period of time that you may marry her and bring her into the company of Israel. So the Mughal Mitzvah Rebbe looks at that and he says, everything in the Torah has not only the level of the world, but also the level of your soul. The beautiful woman is the beautiful part of your soul, but it's captive in you. You don't release it. You don't claim it. You don't realize it's yours. So you have inside of you this beautiful woman, this beauty, but you have to be told by the Torah that it is okay to marry that. In other words, to make it your own. To take the beautiful parts of your soul and integrate them into your personality. And what a perfect message for us to hear before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It takes something that seems at first like it's really a law about warfare and makes it about the meaning of your soul. And the same thing happens in a different way, also about your soul, with Amalek. Now, Amalek, at the very end of our parsha, we're told that you may not remember Amalek. You have to blot it out, and then it says, Lo tishkaf, don't forget. Once again, the rabbis say it's clear that it's not only about Amalek out there. It's got to be something about your soul. And remember, that phrase, lo tishkach, if it sounds familiar, that's because it's very much like that. The Ten Commandments. Lo tinaf, lo tignov, lo ta'anen. And now we get lo tishkach, don't forget. It's phrased the same way as the Ten Commandments, which means that it must have something to do with you, because the Ten Commandments, after all, aren't about other people. They're about each one of us. So what does it mean that you're not supposed to forget, and yet you are supposed to forget? You have a struggle in you. What is Amalek? Amalek is your Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination. It's the part of you that wants to do bad things. On the one hand, you can never forget about it. Lo tishkach, don't forget. On the other hand, you're trying to blot it out, just like you're supposed to blot out Amalek. And this constant struggle with the Amalek inside of us, with the evil inclination, the rabbis find it here in Lo Tishkach. So you get not only the beautiful part of you, which you're supposed to claim, but the rebellious, angry, unbeautiful part of you, which you're supposed to struggle with. And then there is this wonderful passage where it talks about what happens if you're someone you know or just a fellow on the road loses his animal or his garment or so on. What are you supposed to do? You're supposed to help them find it. You're supposed to return it to them if you find it. And then it says, Lo tuchal lehit'alem. You are not able, literally lehit'alem means to hide yourself. But the way that it's translated in our translation is you're not allowed to remain indifferent. In other words, you can't see something that someone lost and say, let them worry about it. A couple of nights ago, Rabbi Fruithandler and I were at the Jewish World Watch meeting. Jewish World Watch, as you may know, is this group that provides supplies, food, medical assistance to people in the most difficult areas of the world. These days, they've been concentrating their efforts on the Congo. Janice Kamener-Resnick, who represents Jewish World Watch, has spoken several times from the Bima. And you know what they say when they talk about why it is that they go there and do this relief work? Because you are not permitted to be indifferent. Lo tuchal lehitalem. One of the ways we use midrash is we take a principle from the Torah and we make it universal. It's not only about finding something that's lost, it's about all the things that are lost in the world. People's freedom, people's dignity, people's right to eat, people's right to raise a family, all those things are lost. And as Jews, we are not allowed literally to hide ourselves from the fact that other people are suffering. So what have we just discovered? With a quick trip through Ki Tetzeh, because all of those things I just told you, they're all in this morning's Parsha. That we have Midrashim that are about Torah. We have midrashim that are about your soul. We have midrashim that are about the world. Now you ask, how could it be that one book has all this and so much more? Because, of course, every interpretation is ultimately, whether it's about Torah, your soul, or the world, about God. And because the Torah is, in our tradition, God's book, it has infinite meanings. It has meanings that you might be able to discover that no one has seen before you. And if you pick up not this book, but a Hebrew version of the Torah that people study, you will see that most often what you have is a little bit of Torah in the middle and comments all around it. Because there is a centuries-old conversation that keeps going on around all the words in this book. Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he was teaching Talmud, he used to say that this is what it was like to teach Talmud or to teach Torah. You sit in a room, and Rashi walks in from the 11th century, and he says something. And then from the 13th century, a commentator comes in and disagrees with Rashi. And then from the 15th century, someone has to decide what the law is. And then from the 19th century, someone has to refine the law. And he said, before you know it, the room is crowded with people. And all of them are arguing over a single sentence and sometimes a single word. We are about to celebrate Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and when those holidays are over, we will have classes, all sorts of classes, with all sorts of study. If you come to them, you will hear the echo of all these voices throughout the generations who are saying to you, look, everything is in this book. Open it, read, listen, learn. You will come to love your tradition and love God's word. Shabbat shalom.